The letter of St. Clement, the Bishop of Rome, is one of the most precious documents among the texts of the Apostolic Fathers. It is as old as some of the newer literature of the New Testament, that is, as old as some of the later documents within the New Testament, such as the Gospel of John and the Revelation of St. John, and perhaps also some of the later epistles. It provides us with a fascinating insight into the mindset of the Christian community in Rome at about the year 96 AD, when it was presumed that it was written, following the Neronian persecutions, when the memory of the death of Peter and Paul was still fresh within the church and giving the church a sense of identity in that city, but also at a time, it would seem, when the Bishop of Rome felt constrained or able to offer advice of a very specific kind to the church in Corinth, which was engaging in what he regarded as an unauthorized expulsion of some of their own church leadership. I've given you selections from this very precious letter and divided the selections up into 7 sections, which you can access with the links at the top of the page. Each of these sections is divided and has its own little captions, which of course do not belong to the text, which would be fairly obvious because each of the captions also has a picture associated with it. And these divided up into segments give you a sense of the overall thrust of the letter. Let me summarize something of what we're going to see. First, we will see the Bishop of Rome, and again, exactly what this means remains slightly obscure. The term episkopos is used in this letter, but we'll see that Clement uses the term episkopos, or what we would now call bishop, as synonymous with, or as a kind of an equivalent of presbyteros, which was later used as the specific term for a presbyter, or what we would today call a priest. Clement does not distinguish between bishops and priests. The higher clergy are either referred to as the presbyteros, or the that is to say, the episkopos or the presbyteroi. The elders are literally what presbyter means. So it would seem that there is a tradition of a ruling body of elders, perhaps headed or leaded or guided by a person designated episkopos, which means overseer and was a term from the Roman Empire in wide use at that time. And then, of course, there is the other rank in addition to these presbyteroi, these elders, also one referred to as episkopos, as leader or overseer. In addition to that, there are also the ranks of the deacons, the servants. Collectively, within his document, he refers to these what we would call clergy as liturgoi, as those who serve the work of the people. The implication is that they have what we would today call liturgical functions, but we would today also refer to these as clerical orders. So as we'll see, for Clement, there really are 2 clerical orders, the presbyters or the episkopos on the one hand, and the diakonos, or those who, quote, wait at table on the other. And we'll see a little more about these as we go along. In addition to that, we also see very clearly in the letter a doctrine of apostolic succession. Clement wants to make it clear that the problem with the church in Corinth expelling its leadership is that they don't have the authority to. Leadership, he says, comes from the apostles, which is to say it comes from Christ, and therefore it comes from God. And you cannot, on your own authority, simply set it aside, because this represents a continuous presence of God in the church, overseeing and guiding the individual churches. Now, let's take a look at the text itself. Beginning at the top in chapter 5, he gives the example to recall the church at Corinth to its noble heritage, and the heritage particularly enjoyed by the church in Rome, that there have been righteous pillars of the church persecuted and put to death. The implication of this, of course, is that the Corinthians are now engaging in their own kind of persecution by expelling their own church leadership. This Clement says, is done through envy and jealousy, the same motivation in their own churches that resulted in the death and destruction decades before of Saints Peter and Paul in the church at Rome. And he seems to be referring specifically to their persecution, of which there's a picture and a description below that text. And he particularly highlights, let us set before our eyes, the illustrious example of Peter, who endured numerous labors and then suffered martyrdom, and Paul, who obtained the reward of endurance, being 7 times thrown into captivity. This is all at the end of chapter 5. And this very precious phrase, after preaching both in the East and the West, gained the illustrious reputation due to his faith, having taught righteousness to the whole world and come to the extreme limits of the West. This is the origin of the tradition that St. Paul may have preached in Spain, having gone to the extreme ends of the empire, to the so-called Pillars of Hercules or Gibraltar, and then having returned to Rome, suffered persecution and was killed, beheaded because he was a Roman citizen, whereas St. Peter, who did not enjoy Roman citizenship, was tortured to death through crucifixion, the legend says, through crucifixion at his own request, upside down, since he regarded himself as not worthy to suffer in the same way as the Lord. So here the author to this letter, St. Clement, is reminding the church in Corinth that the persecutions of the past should not be repeated in the present by Christians themselves. It was the pagans, that is to say the Roman leadership, who persecuted the church. It should not be the church who persecutes its own. Now this reminds us of the fact that in this era, in the ninth and last decade of the first century, the Christian church was very conscious of persecution, and we know this from the later epistles and especially from the revelation of John. The notion of the possibility or the reality of the leadership of the empire being opposed to the Christian church was very prominent in people's minds. It would seem, and we'll address this question in other texts, that it was probably during Nero's reign, during that terrible period where Christians were burned alive and tortured to death in other ways because of being blamed for the great fire, which Nero himself may have been responsible for. He needed a convenient excuse. And the excuse was found in this group of people, this new cult, which was regarded as hating humankind because they seemed to be so inwardly turned. They seemed to be concerned with their own members, and they were not participating in secular life, which meant the festivals that involved the worship of pagan deities. Christians were regarded as not sociable, as not participating in society, and probably haters of humankind, and certainly as atheists, as people who did not believe in the gods of the empire. So they had been persecuted under Nero, and it is possibly during Nero's era that Christianity became a proscribed religion. It's much debated whether or not simply the name of being a Christian was sufficient at this time and later as a legal cause or a legal reason for Christians to be persecuted, but it is certainly possible that it was during his era and certainly following his example that later persecuting emperors and many persecuting governors would cite these precedents going back to the time of Nero for the illegality of Christianity. If we drop down now to the section marked, chapter 36, we have very briefly something that is of interest to us from the standpoint of the history of Christian spirituality, an example in this tremendously early literature of contemplative prayer. It is Christ through whom Clement will say, we behold the heavens. In chapter 36, he says, by him we look up to the heights of heavens, we behold in a mirror his immaculate visage, the eyes of our hearts are opened. We blossom, our darkened understanding blossoms towards his light, and we taste immortal knowledge, because Christ is the brightness of the divine majesty. So there is a very beautiful image of Christ as the light that opens up and moves out the darkness of our own hearts. If we drop down now to what I've marked as sections 4 and 5, that is in chapters 40 and 42, what we'll find is the beginnings of Clement's doctrine of apostolic succession. First, in chapter 40, he says that the ecclesiastical ranks, the orders of church leadership within Christianity, are modeled, he says, on Jewish temple practice. And so we catch a link with a strong sense of connectedness with the Jewish community. One can catch glimpses of a kind of Jewish Christianity present perhaps in Clement's model of church leadership, where you have these presbyteroi or elders, rather reminiscent of the synagogue elders from the first century BC onwards, but also in his insistence that within the Christian ranks of the clergy one has a continuity with, the continuation of these older models of Jewish temple practice. We see in chapter 40 that he distinguishes four levels: the high priest, then behavior or actions proper to the priests, things proper to the Levites, and then proper forms of offering or of service that belong to the laity. And now he will allow this to correspond to these two ranks of the clergy that he describes, the presbyters / bishops, the presbyteroi episcopoi on the one hand, and the deacons, diaconoi, on the other. Again, remembering that Clement does not distinguish between presbyters and bishops. He uses the same term to describe this same category of individuals to which he belongs. So in number 42, he describes the apostolic origins of the episcopate and the diaconate. He says, "The apostles preached the gospel to us from Christ. Christ had done this from God," and then he moves back kind of in an ascending hierarchy. "Christ therefore was sent from God, and the apostles were sent from Christ." So there is this cascading downward from God the Father to Jesus Christ to us. "We have received therefore from the apostles, and the apostles have received from Christ, and Christ from God." And now he corresponds this, or allows this to correspond a little further down in the same chapter, with these ranks of bishops, episcopoi, and deacons, diaconoi. And he justifies the use of these terms, which we know are already present in the pastoral epistles, are already mentioned in the New Testament. He lists these ranks using and here's a misquote from the Septuagint of Isaiah 60:17. He says, and he tries to find a text, "I will appoint their bishops, their episcopoi in righteousness, and their deacons, their diaconoi in faith." Well, that's not exactly correct. That isn't correct at all. That's a miscitation from the Septuagint, which you have the correct quotation from. The actual quotation is that "I will make your princes peaceable and your overseers righteous." In Isaiah, these are not two separate categories. These are two words, one of which is being used as an adjective. And in fact, the problem is that the word diakonos or deacon is very similar to the word dikaios, which means righteous or just. And there's been a misplacing of the yoda of one letter, which allows this word for righteous to look instead like the word for servant or deacon, the one who waits at table. Well, it doesn't really matter, of course, from the standpoint of the development of doctrine, that he's misquoting the Septuagint. As far as he's concerned, and this is what we should remember, these orders are from God. They originate with Christ, and they are given to us. He then, in chapter 43, if we continue dropping down, points out that what the Corinthians are doing in their church is living out again the same strife that existed in the Old Testament concerning the priesthood. And then if we drop down onto section to page 44, we now have a clear statement of a doctrine of apostolic succession. "For him, these bishops, the episkopos or the presbyteros, the bishops or presbyters, are those who offer the gifts," namely those who are entrusted with offering the Eucharist, who preside at the Eucharistic celebration, "and they have been appointed," he says, "through Christ." Chapter 44, "Our apostles knew through our Lord Jesus that there would be strife, and for this reason they had obtained a perfect foreknowledge, and the apostles appointed those ministers already mentioned," that is, bishops and deacons, "and afterwards gave instructions that other men should succeed them in their ministry." So the apostles have the right to appoint others, and this continues the ministry they themselves received by God. And he said, therefore, and this is his conclusion, those who are appointed by the apostles or by other eminent men with the consent of the whole church. He has this sense that the church itself, in the presence of those, as we'll see when we look at the documents that describe ordination, in the presence of both the people of God and those who are presiding over the ceremony, they give consent to this rite of ordination, and that represents the consent of the whole church that validates the choice of the individuals and then the laying on of hands that continues this apostolic succession. Therefore, he concludes, and by the way, that specific point, the laying on of hands, is not mentioned here as the particular sign that we will find in other texts. In chapter 45, he says that Corinthians are to remember that their zeal should be reserved for things of God, and they should not be full of zeal for things that actually disrupt the church. They are zealous about things, he says, that do not pertain to salvation. And again, if we just look back for a second, just above chapter 45, the last few verses of chapter 44, it's important to note that he defines the episcopate, he defines the episkopos, particularly as those who have blamelessly and worthily offered the gifts. They are those who offer to God the gifts, which is to say, the Eucharistic gifts. And he, in a kind of a parallel way, refers to them also as presbyters, as elders, who have finished their course and obtained a fruitful and perfect departure from this world. So again, what we find in this very beautiful and precious letter is a description of early church order in which there are not three but two principal levels of the clergy: the elders, which can be referred to as presbyters or bishops, and are referred to as both by St. Clement, and then the deacons, who are involved in service, probably as we find already described in the book of Acts, particularly with social service in the Christian community, but perhaps also service particularly at the liturgy. This is validated or verified in what few liturgical documents we have from this period, which we'll particularly see in the Didache. But the higher rank of the clergy, the episkopos or the presbyteros, the bishop or elder, being the one who has responsibility for offering the Eucharistic gifts and thus presiding over the community, and who is regarded as in a succession coming from Christ through the apostles and through those who then were entrusted with the apostles to the ministry of continuing this leadership in the church.